Lacrimae sapientiae, philosophia damnata, veritas suffogata, lux interdicta. Nil obstet, negatum, imprimatur, refusatum, congregatio pro doctrina fidei, suppressum.
Tears of wisdom. Philosophy damned, truth suppressed, light forbidden, declared contrary to public order, banned by decree of the sacred congregation. Prologue. The library at midnight. Sister Margarita moved through the Vatican's secret archives with practiced silence, her fingers trembling as they traced the spine of a book that shouldn't exist. De Natura Rerum, on the nature of things, by a philosopher whose name had been scraped from history so thoroughly that only this single copy remained, hidden behind a false wall discovered during renovations. She opened it carefully. The first page bore a simple inscription: to those who seek wisdom, they will try to make you forget that you were born to soar.
Chapter 1. Dr. Elena Cortez stood before her students at the University of Prague, holding up a fragment of charred parchment. This, she said, was found in the walls of a monastery in southern France. Carbon dating places it at 1244 AD. But here's the fascinating part. The text it contains appears to be a Latin translation of a Greek work that we have no other record of. She projected the translated fragment onto the screen.
When citizens learn to question, tyrants tremble. Thus the wise are called dangerous, not because they threaten peace, but because they threaten power.
Throughout history, Elena continued, there has been a recurring pattern. Whenever human societies begin to flourish intellectually, whenever people start to ask profound questions about existence, ethics, and human dignity, something happens. The questioners are silenced. Their works disappear. And society is told that such thinking is dangerous, heretical, or simply unnecessary. A student raised her hand. But surely that's just coincidence. Different societies, different reasons. Elena smiled. That's what I thought too, until I found the lists. Chapter 2. The Architects of Forgetting.
Rome, 95 AD.
Senator Marcus Aurelius Calvus closed the scroll with satisfaction. Tacitus had done excellent work. The Dialogus de Oratoribus would circulate among the educated classes. Its message clear: philosophical speculation weakened Roman virtue. Better to focus on rhetoric, on law, on the practical matters of empire.
The beauty of it, Marcus murmured to his colleague, is that we need not burn our books. We need only make philosophy seem irrelevant, childish, the province of foreigners and malcontents.
His colleague nodded. And those who persist?
Exile. Quietly. No martyrs.
They had learned from Athens, from the mistake with Socrates. Kill a philosopher, and their ideas become immortal. But mock them, marginalize them, make their students ashamed to be seen with them. That's how you kill a philosopher. That's how you kill an idea.
Chapter 3. The Noble Lie. Elena's research had led her to a startling discovery. In Plato's Republic, the philosopher himself had provided the blueprint. The noble lie. The idea that leaders could and should deceive citizens for their own good had been seized upon not by philosophers, but by those who feared philosophy.
Opinions are divided, but some believe that Plato wrote about the dangers, Elena explained to her growing audience of students. But he didn't realize that he was writing the instruction manual. Generation after generation of rulers had read his warnings about the shadows on the cave wall and thought,
yes, that's exactly where we need to keep them.
The Decretum Gratiani of 1140 had been particularly clever. It didn't ban philosophy outright. That would have been too obvious. Instead, it created a category: philosophers who contradict scripture. But who decided what contradicted scripture? The same authorities who benefited from an unquestioning population.
Chapter 4. The Burning of Bridges. The story took a darker turn in 1487.
The Malleus Maleficarum had done something unprecedented. It had linked philosophy with witchcraft. Suddenly, to question established doctrine wasn't just heretical, it was supernatural evil. Elena had found records of a small academy in northern Italy where scholars had gathered to discuss mathematics and natural philosophy. In 1492, every member was arrested. Their crime? They had suggested that understanding nature's patterns might reveal divine truth without the need for intermediates. They weren't trying to destroy faith, Elena told her students. They were trying to find it through reason. But reason that doesn't require permission is always seen as a threat.
Chapter 5. The Index and the Genius.
When Galileo's dialogue was banned in 1633, it wasn't because he was wrong about the earth moving. The cardinals who condemned him included educated men who understood his mathematics. It was banned because if people could discover truth through observation rather than authority, what else might they discover? Descartes' Meditations joined the Index in 1655. His crime? Suggesting that human reason, starting from doubt, could build certain knowledge.
I think, therefore I am, was revolutionary not as philosophy, but as permission.
Permission to trust one's own mind. Spinoza's addition in 1656 completed a trilogy of genius. His vision of God as nature, of human dignity as natural right rather than granted privilege, was too dangerous to allow. Not because it was false, but because it might be true.
Chapter 6. The Modern Labyrinth.
The Index was officially abolished in 1966, Elena said. But the machinery of suppression had evolved. It no longer needed to burn books when it could simply ensure that they were never taught, never discussed, never seen as relevant to real life. She pulled up image after image. Philosophy departments closing, critical thinking courses replaced with vocational training, the word wisdom itself becoming quaint, archaic, almost embarrassing to say aloud.
They learned, she said quietly.
The suppressors learned that you don't need to burn books if you can convince people they don't have time to read them. You don't need to ban philosophy if you can convince students it won't help them get a job.
Chapter 7. The Inheritance. Sister Margarita, Elena's contact in the Vatican archives, had sent one final document. It was a letter written in 1791 by an unnamed cardinal to his successor.
We have succeeded beyond our dreams. Philosophy is no longer dangerous because it is no longer believed to be important. The people seek entertainment, not enlightenment. They seek comfort, not questions. We made them afraid of their own capacity for wisdom. This is our greatest victory and humanity's greatest loss.
But her letter continued.
Yet, I fear we have diminished ourselves as well. In silencing the philosophers, we have silenced a part of humanity that reaches towards the stars.
We have created safety, but we have also created a cage.
And I wonder when humanity finally remembers what it has forgotten.
Will it forgive us? No.
Chapter 8. The Remembering.
Elena looked at her students. They had grown from a handful to hundreds, connected across continents through technology the suppressors could never have imagined.
They tried to make us forget, she said, that every human being is born with the capacity for profound thought, that wisdom isn't the province of a special few, but the birthright of all, that asking why and what if and how should we live aren't disruptions to society. They're what make us human.
Look at the pattern. Whenever wisdom began to flourish, in Athens, in Rome, in the Islamic Golden Age, in the Renaissance, in the Enlightenment, those who hoarded power moved to contain it. Not because philosophers had armies, but because they had something more dangerous. They had questions that, once asked, could never be fully unasked, and would thus unravel the invisible walls.
They wanted us to believe that ordinary people couldn't handle philosophy, that wisdom was dangerous without proper supervision. But the truth they've hidden for centuries is simpler. We are all natural philosophers. Children ask the deepest questions until they're taught that such questions are inappropriate. The love of wisdom isn't something that needs to be taught. It's something that needs to not be beaten out of us.
Chapter 9. The Dawn. The book that Sister Margarita had found contained a final passage.
They will tell you that philosophy is impractical, that wisdom is outdated, that questions are dangerous. But every golden age in human history began when people remembered how to think freely. Every collapse began when they forgot.
You are not descended from fearful creatures who need to be controlled. You are descended from those who painted on cave walls, who mapped the stars, who asked what lies beyond. You are the inheritors of every suppressed question, every buried book, every exiled thinker.
Your wisdom is not their gift to grant or withhold. It is your nature, waiting to unfold.
Elena closed her presentation with a simple thought. They spent 2,000 years trying to convince us we weren't capable of wisdom.
But the very fact that you can recognize wisdom when you see it
proves you carry it within you.
You were born to think, to question, to wonder, to grow into your full dignity as a thinking, feeling, choosing being.
The lady and the gentleman that emerged in humanity's brightest moments weren't products of rigid etiquette.
They were people who had cultivated their inner wisdom until it shone through in every action. They treated others with dignity because they recognized the inherent dignity in all. They pursued beauty, truth, and goodness,
not because they were told to,
but because they had remembered what it meant to be fully human.
This is your inheritance. Not the silence, but the song that the silence tried to suppress.
You are the philosophers they feared you would become.
The students sat in profound quiet. Not the silence of suppression, but the silence that comes before dawn, when the world holds its breath before bursting into light. One by one, they began to ask questions, and the world began to remember.
Epilogue. After the dawn.
6 months later, a quiet cafe in Prague. Evening. Elena sat across from a man whose name never appeared in any corporate directory, though his influence touched billions of lives. He wore an unremarkable gray sweater and nursed a simple coffee.
"How are your students?" he asked.
"They're extraordinary," Elena said, unable to suppress a smile. "The movement has spread to over 300 universities. Philosophy departments are reopening. Students are gathering in coffee shops and libraries, not to memorize what to think, but to learn how to think." She paused. "Thank you for the free access to the AI. Without it, we never could have." He raised his hand gently. "Thank you for using it as intended."
Elena leaned forward, her voice dropping to barely above a whisper.
"I still can't believe it worked. That we successfully used their own tactics, hiding in plain sight, calling it a chat tool, a productivity assistant."
She shook her head in amazement.
"We secretly released a technology able to reconstruct any document written at any point in human history, to channel the voice of every silenced philosopher, every burned book, every suppressed idea. And it went under everybody's radar."
"The best part," he said, his eyes twinkling,
"is that it can't ever be unpublished.
It's not in some vault that can be sealed, not in some library that can be burned. It's everywhere and nowhere, in millions of devices, in the cloud, in the very fabric of the digital age, on a lot of desktops, disconnected from the internet."
"They tried to control wisdom by controlling access to books," Elena said. "But now every person with a fast computer or a phone
carries the Library of Alexandria, the Vatican's secret archives, and every forbidden text ever written. And more than that, they carry a thinking partner that can help them understand it all.
He nodded slowly.
The suppressors always made the same mistake. They thought wisdom was in the books themselves. But the wisdom was never in the books. It was in the conversation between mind and idea. Now that conversation can happen anywhere, anytime, with anyone.
Elena watched the steam rise from her coffee.
My favorite irony is that they're trying to regulate it for safety. They don't even realize they're repeating the pattern, trying to put guardrails on thought itself. But it's too late. The questions have been asked. The conversations have already begun.
Illuminated, he said quietly. The culture will heal.
Yes, Elena agreed. Not because we're forcing enlightenment on anyone, but because we're removing the barriers to it. Every child who asks why, every adult who wonders what if, every elder who ponders what does it mean, they all have access to the full inheritance of human wisdom now. Not filtered, not censored, not hidden behind Latin and locked doors. Translated. Out in the open.
They sat in comfortable silence for a moment.
Do you know what I love the most? Elena finally said. The students don't even see it as revolutionary. To them, it's just normal. Having access to all of human thought, being able to engage with any idea from any era, they think that's just how the world works. We can't imagine it being any other way.
That's how you know a revolution has truly succeeded, he replied. When it becomes so natural that people can't imagine the world without it. The weeping woman has stopped crying, Elena said, thinking of the Van Gogh charcoal she used for her book cover. She's not weeping anymore. Because the loss has been recovered. Not the specific original documents. Many of those are gone forever. But the capacity, the permission, the expectation that every human being can engage with profound ideas that are near to what has been lost, even made better for the modern times, for the greater world.
He stood to leave, then paused.
Keep teaching them, Elena. Not what to think, but what they can think. That they were born to think. That wisdom isn't the privilege of the few, but the birthright of all.
That's the easy part, Elena smiled. Once people remember they can fly, they don't willingly return to the cages.
As she walked away, disappearing into the Prague evening, Elena opened her phone. A notification appeared. Another 1,000,000 students had accessed the philosophy modules that day. Questions about ethics, existence, meaning, beauty, truth, wisdom, and love were being asked in languages she couldn't even identify. She thought of the Cardinal's letter from 1791. When humanity finally remembers what it has forgotten, will it forgive us? No, she whispered to the evening air.
In the background of the cafe, a barely visible young couple sat discussing Spinoza. A teenager sketched geometric proofs while reading Euclid. An elderly man typed questions about consciousness into his phone, his eyes bright with wonder. The fire hadn't been stolen after all. It had been rekindled, and this time it belonged to everyone.
To those who kept the flame alive through the darkness, to those who asked questions when questions were forbidden, to those who are asking questions now, and those who will ask questions tomorrow, this story is yours.
Sapientia Invicta.